Good day. Today is Tuesday, 11th November, 2025. And before I begin, let me remind you once again to tick the like button if, having watched the programme, or such part of the programme as you want to watch, you've liked what you've heard and want to indicate that fact. Let me now turn to the topics of discussion in our programme today. And again, mostly they are going to be about the conflict in Ukraine, though I do want to say a few things about the situation in my own country, in Britain, though I will say them at the end of this programme. Well, perhaps the most extraordinary piece of news that's come out of the conflict in Ukraine, as of this morning, are claims made by Russia's counterintelligence agency, the FSB, that it has detected and exposed a plot by Ukraine's special services to engineer the defection of a Russian pilot flying a MiG-31 fighter jet with a complete Kinjal missile. And the FSB has provided information about this plot, which on the face of it appears to be extraordinary, because according to the FSB, the pilot who was contacted and who was invited to defect was supposed to murder the navigator of the MiG-31 that he was flying. I should say that MiG-31s operate with two crew. They have a pilot and a navigator. And apparently, the pilot was supposed to carry out some kind of false flag attack or kind of attack using the Kinjal missile against the big NATO base in the Romanian town of Constanza. The FSB also says that the British intelligence services were involved, and it has even accused the agency Bellingcat, which I believe is now based in the Netherlands, of being involved as well. What are we to make of all of this? Well, the first thing to say is that it is not inconceivable that the Ukrainians, and by the way, the British, and by the way, other Western intelligence agencies as well, might have tried to bribe a Russian pilot or pilots to defect with a MiG-31 fighter jet and a Kinjal hypersonic missile. Both the fighter jet and the missile would obviously be very interesting to Western intelligence agencies. I would add that there is history of this sort of thing. I remember how back during the Cold War in 1975, a Soviet MiG-25 fighter jet, a fighter jet which is a lineal ancestor of the MiG-31, was flown to Japan by a Soviet pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Belenko, who allegedly was bribed by the United States to defect, though there are some doubts about some aspects of that story, which I'm not going to spend time talking about on this program. Anyway, suffice to say, a MiG-31 was or did reach Japan during the Cold War, and the West, the United States, its intelligence agencies then took it apart, examined it in detail, provided reports about it, many of which circulated in the media at that time, tried to downplay the effectiveness of this fighter jet. There was a certain amount of misinformation about the nature of this fighter jet as well. Anyway, the long and the short of it was a defection was indeed achieved. So there is a precedent for this kind of thing. And by the way, I've heard stories which I cannot confirm that there were many other attempts during the Cold War especially by the United States, to persuade other Soviet pilots to defect with their fighter jets also. Anyway, as I said, this isn't in and of itself an impossible story. It would also, I have to say, not surprise me if the British were indeed involved at some level. But the Russians now have a habit of tracing the British, a British sign, into every Ukrainian covert and intelligence operation. And, well, of course, it may be true. I've discussed on many occasions how in Britain we do seem to be addicted to these kind of James Bond activities. It's not impossible that this took place on this occasion, but of course there's no evidence of it that I'm aware of that the Russians at least have produced. So I think that the bare bones of the story about an intelligence plot to try to get a Russian pilot to defect with a MiG-31 is probably true, and it could be that the British were involved. The other aspects of the story, the more baroque ones, the story about murdering the navigator, attacking the base in Constanza, about all of these, I am much more sceptical. And though I'm not saying that they're false, all I would say is that perhaps, just possibly, there has been some embroidery added to this story, though, of course, they might, as I said, be true. Anyway, there it is. This particular incident has been flagged up by the Russians. They're talking about this. It's dominating their media about the Ukraine conflict this morning. I think that's really all I can say. One final further thought. Reading between the lines, I wonder whether, again, there might have been a Russian sting operation here. I can remember that there have been various other attempts by the Ukrainians and their Western intelligence friends purportedly to get Russian pilots to defect. I remember that there was an incident involving helicopter pilots earlier in the war, for example. I felt at the time with that incident that there were some signs that the Russians had led the Ukrainians along, and I wonder whether perhaps they did this to some extent in this case also. And it could be that some of the more extraordinary parts of this story, the attack on Constanza, the purported intended attack on Constanza, the murder of the navigator, might be a reflection of this. But I don't want to claim to know more about this incident than I do. I know absolutely nothing about this incident except what the FSB is saying. All I would say is that an attempt to stage a spectacular defection of a pilot with his MiG-31 and his Kinzhal missile is far from impossible. And that part of the story rings to me as if it is likely true. Anyway, we should not let further instances in the spy war distract us from what is actually going on in the battle. And the battle in Ukraine continues, and it continues to get worse and worse in Ukraine. Now, as I have tended to do increasingly recently, I'm going to turn first to what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying. They provided their account of the fighting in Pokrovsk. They say that in Pokrovsk, assault groups of the Second Army continue to conduct intensive foreign intensive offensive actions in the northwestern and eastern quarters of the Central District, as well as in the area of the train station's depot. In the past 24 hours, 256 buildings have been liberated. And I said yesterday that there's been a huge upsurge in the number of buildings in Pokrovsk that the Russians are now claiming to be capturing on any particular day. We've jumped from, say, 24 buildings a day, which was already quite a lot, to hundreds of buildings a day. And that clearly indicates to me that what is happening is not fighting, but the Russians moving into buildings which the Ukrainians have abandoned, checking them for booby traps and possible stragglers. In other words, clearing buildings, mostly unopposed. This speed of liberating buildings can only, in my opinion, be explained in this way. So anyway, 256 buildings in Pokrovsk over the last 24 hours. Then the Russian Defense Ministry continues to say that the Second Army assault forces continue to mop up Rog from Ukrainian troops, and 98 buildings have been liberated. Now, I said in my program yesterday that I knew where Gnatovka was, Gnatovka, the other village that the Russians were seeking to capture, immediately to the east of Pokrovsk, but I couldn't find Rog, and I wondered whether perhaps, just possibly, Rog might be appearing on the maps, on the maps I see, under a different name, given that naming conventions in Ukraine and Russia are different. Well, clarity about the whereabouts of Rog was provided last night for me by the inestimable Marat Khairulin on his indispensable blog, the one he prepares with Zinder Neuf. And he provided a detailed explanation of the fighting in western Pokrovsk, or west of Pokrovsk. And there was clearly a clear map which identified, which showed precisely where Gnatovka is, and you could see Rog located just north of it. Gnatovka turns out to be a mining village. It includes industrial buildings and various other facilities connected to the mining industry. And Rog, which is located, as I said, immediately to the west and north of Gnatovka, is similar. Apparently, they were both mining villages, suburbs of Pokrovsk, Krasnoarmeysk, as the Russians, and before then the Soviets, referred to Pokrovsk, which was itself an industrial centre and a mining village, a mining town, essentially a mining town. Anyway, the information, the fact that, according to the Russian Defence Ministry, the Russians have liberated 98 buildings in Rog points again to the fact that the Ukrainians have withdrawn from this village. The village, in other words, like Gnatovka, is about to pass entirely under Russian control. Looking at a map, it doesn't appear to be. Looking at Marat Khairulin's map, it does not look to be a big place. So these two villages on the western fringes of Pokrovsk have passed entirely under control of the Russians, or in the case of Rog, are about to. And Khairulin pointed out that east of Roch, east of Gnatovka and Roch, there is only open fields until one reaches Mirnograd. And my own view, frankly, is that the Russians will very soon be in complete control of these fields, if they are not so already. And that the village of Sukhye Yar, which is located to the very south, to the south, at the southern tip of the Pokrovsk cauldron, my guess is that the Russians will very quickly be mopping that village as well. And again, I doubt by now that there are any Ukrainians there. Now, Khairulin has also provided information about the two Ukrainian units that are located in Mirnograd, which now form the core of the Ukrainian forces still in the Pokrovsk cauldron. One is a marine brigade and the other is a mechanized infantry brigade, both of which, it appears to me, must be considered elite units. My recollection, and here I might be wrong, is that Ukraine has a total of 5 marine brigades. They've never operated as marines as such, but they have always been considered elite infantry. They were the forces that Ukraine used to defend Mariupol, one of the brigades that Ukraine stationed to defend Mariupol, which conducted the counteroffensive in 2023 in the Vremevka salient, failed counteroffensive there, and which were also used by the Ukrainians in 2023 and 2024 in the disastrous Krinky operation to land on the Russian-controlled east bank of the Dnieper River in Kherson region. So an elite brigade by the Ukrainian military, of the Ukrainian military, an elite marine brigade, is trapped in the Pokrovsk cauldron. And whilst I know nothing about the other brigade, I suspect that it is also an elite unit as well. So these are not, as some have suggested, territorial troops, mobilized troops. These continue to be some of Ukraine's best units with some of its better trained men. Khairulin puts the number of Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd at between 2,000 and 3,000, which is rather more than some of the other figures that I have seen, but we will probably only find out when the battle for Mirnograd itself is over. In a sense, it no longer makes sense to talk about the Pokrovsk cauldron. More accurately now, it should be called the Mirnograd cauldron, because that is where the Ukrainians now mostly are. There are still apparently some Ukrainian holdouts in two specific places in northern Pokrovsk, but these represent only small percentages, less than 5% of the entire territory of the town. Mostly the cauldron now is centered on Mirnograd itself. Anyway, the Russians have more to say about the situation in Pokrovsk, in the Pokrovsk cauldron. First of all, they say that there were seven attacks were made to try to break through or break out of the Pokrovsk cauldron. All of them were repelled. 3 used armoured vehicles, 1 attack by the 32nd Mechanized Brigade of the Ukrainian Army from the area of Grishina. in order to unblock the encircled group of the Ukrainian troops. Up to 17 units of military hardware and up to 30 men were neutralized, whatever that means. And then the defense ministry says that an attempt to break through the encirclement by the 38th Marine Brigade in the direction of Novoekonomichne was also thwarted. So this is the Marine Brigade I was talking about. It apparently made what I have to say looks to me like a very desperate attempt to try to break out from Mirnograd eastwards. But, well, that would have been a hopeless operation, and it clearly failed. And anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry then claims that in Mirnograd, units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade of the Russian Army enlarged the offensive in the Vostochny district and southern part of the settlement and towards the Zapadny micro-district. And then they say this: over the past 24 hours, more than 236 troops and 27 different weapons of the Ukrainian military have been neutralized in the Pokrovsk direction, including 7 armored fighting vehicles, 10 motor vehicles and 2 artillery units. It seems to me that if you believe the Russian Defense Ministry, then losses, Ukrainian losses, in the Pokrovsk cauldron are now multiplying, even as the number of buildings that the Russians claim to be capturing in the Pokrovsk cauldron are also multiplying. It remains my view, which I discussed in my program yesterday, in fact, not just my view, but my certainty, that the major effort the Russians are making in relation to the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd is to try to persuade them to surrender. There have been increasing numbers of individual surrenders, apparently. But for the moment, at least, the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk are continuing to resist these calls and remain where they are. This, as I discussed in my program yesterday, cannot continue indefinitely. At some point, inevitably, it will end. Now, the Russians have also provided a lot of information, more information than they did yesterday, about the situation in Kupiansk. And they start by saying this: assault detachments of the 6th Army continue to destroy the encircled group close to Kupiansk. The eastern part of the city has been completely liberated. Now, that is dramatic news if it means what I think it means, which is the entire industrial district east of the east of the Oskol River. Now, we've had some further comments from the Russian officer known by the call sign Lovets, who has provided us with a running commentary of what his unit is doing. And he says this: the detachment continues to operate in the industrial area in the east of Kupiansk. Dzerzhinsky Street was mopped up from Ukrainian troops. We seized a petroleum product storage and distribution center on the eastern outskirts of Kupiansk. Olivino and Park Vostochnovo Pribitya railway stations have been liberated and are now controlled by Russian troops. Our detachment is engaged in combat operations to mop up the Kupiansk Sortirovochnaya railway station. We deliver strikes at the enemy's positions near Kupiansk Uzlovoy. Kupiansk Uzlovoy is a suburb of Kupiansk, still under Ukrainian control. It looks to me as if it's detached from the main town, but it is located, as far as I can tell, on the west bank of the Oskol River. And notice that Lavets is talking about his unit conducting strikes at the enemy's positions near Kupiansk Uzlovoy, which suggests that these are long-range artillery strikes. Anyway, again, I am not there. I am not able to speak precisely about what is going on. But on the face of it, it looks as if Ukrainian resistance on the east bank of the Oskol River in the industrial sector of Kupiansk, the area where the greatest number of trapped Ukrainian units were located, at least according to my understanding of the battle. Anyway, it looks as if Ukrainian resistance there has now collapsed. And the defense ministry, the Russian defense ministry, continues. The enemy leaves no attempt to break through to the surrounded units. Over the past 24 hours, an attack of the 1st National Guard Brigade units in order to unblock the surrounded units has been repelled in the southern area of Kupiansk, Uzlovoy. And so it looks as if the fighting has now moved to this area on the southern end of Kupiansk, on the west bank of the Oskol River. And the defense ministry says up to 60 troops, 16 pieces of military equipment have been neutralized, including 5 armored fighting vehicles, 1 counterfire radar station, 3 electronic warfare stations, and 5 pickup trucks. There we go. So that's what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying. Now, a couple of days ago, the 2 Ukrainian commanders, Lovets and Lavrik, both said that they expected Kupiansk to fall completely under Russian control over the course of the following week. We are now several days into that week, and this latest report from Lovets and from the Russian Defense Ministry about the fall of eastern Kupiansk suggests that it is indeed the case that the Battle of Kupiansk is now close to its end. Perhaps, and again, bear in mind that I myself am not there, perhaps the entire battle now is taking place in Kupiansk Uzlovoy on the west bank of the river. Anyway, there it is, the Oskol River. Anyway, there it is. That's the situation, as far as I can work it out, in the area of the two cauldrons. Now, there has been a change, or so it seems to me, in the rhetoric that is coming from the officials, the Ukrainian officials. Yesterday, General Sirsky, the Ukrainian military chief, as I discussed, made comments early in the course of the day, talking about how the situation in Pokrovsk was under control, how the Russian attacks had lost their intensity, how it was untrue that the Ukrainians were blockaded in Pokrovsk, how the Ukrainians still retain a presence in Pokrovsk. Then, a couple of hours later, after I made my video, but before it was published, over the course of yesterday, Sirsky made further comments in which he spoke about thousands of Russian troops pouring into Pokrovsk and preparing the last big attack in Pokrovsk, which was intended finally to clear the entire town. And there have been all kinds of reports from Ukrainian telegram channels and reporting channels about large numbers, thousands of Russian troops. Again, we're back to hearing about 100,000, I believe, Russian troops. As I spoke in my program yesterday about how the numbers always change, but about hundreds of thousands of Russian troops pouring into Pokrovsk on vehicles, on motorbikes, on all kinds of things, preparing for the last big attack that would sweep all resistance before it. And there were complaints from the Ukrainians that all of this has been happening in conditions of heavy fog, which made it impossible for the Ukrainians to operate their drones effectively or to keep proper track of what is actually happening inside Pokrovsk. I suspect that this is all part of the game of preparations, this time by Sirski, for the final acknowledgement that Pokrovsk is indeed lost, that the battle of Pokrovsk has ended with the Russians in control. After his various confident predictions that Pokrovsk would hold, after Zelensky's claims that there were only 300 Russian troops there and that the Ukrainians were in the process of mopping them up and all that, the Ukrainians now need some narrative, some explanation to explain why Pokrovsk is about to pass entirely under Russian control. And Sirski has just provided it. Hundreds of thousands of Russian troops pouring into Pokrovsk in vehicles and motorcycles and all of that, carrying out the final assault, overwhelming the Ukrainians by sheer weight of numbers, bringing Pokrovsk firmly, entirely under Russian control. After all, despite the heroic resistance that the Ukrainians mounted in the city. So, Sirski's comments yesterday are perhaps the first official acknowledgement from someone close to Zelensky that the battle of Pokrovsk is indeed about to be lost. Now, I read some further reports about Pokrovsk yesterday. I read in, I think it might have been Larry Johnson's blog, Sonar 21, that the population of the entire conurbation, the Pokrovsk conurbation, that's Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, and all of the villages, the small villages, which are really perhaps better understood as suburbs that lie around it, this entire territory which is about to pass under Russian control, before the war, amounted to some 200,000 people. That might perhaps have been the population just before the Soviet Union broke up. But I suspect, my memory anyway, is that I saw somewhere that it had fallen considerably from that level by the time the war started in February 2022. But obviously Pokrovsk and Mirnograd and all of these other places which are about to pass in their entirety under Russian control are not small and insignificant places, little towns, little mining towns that one would have difficulty finding on a map, and which, if one drives through them, one would barely notice. No doubt they were bleak, perhaps in some respects bleak and industrial places. Though, of course, it should be stressed, they were people's homes. And people lived there and perhaps happily lived there. But the point is that we're not talking about a small place. Yesterday, on the Duran, we were privileged to do a programme with Scott of Calibrated. His programme, Calibrated, is one of the best channels discussing the military situation in Ukraine and indeed other geopolitical topics as well. And Scott carefully explained the importance of Pokrovsk, the fact that it is on an elevation, the fact that if the Russians want to advance westwards, there are no significant obstacles in their way until they reach Pavlograd, the city which lies just east of the Dnieper River and the great city of Dnieper, and which, by the way, from what I can see, it would be relatively straightforward for the Russians to encircle and capture, just say. But anyway, the Russians would be in a position to do that. And of course, they can also advance northwards. They can capture places like Dobropilia and Druzhivka. In the case of the capture of Druzhivka, they will have encircled Konstantinovka, where fighting is already underway. And following the fall of Konstantinovka, there will basically be only two places, significant places, where the Ukrainians are still able to put up resistance. And that is the towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And these, in turn, would be at serious risk fairly quickly of being surrounded. Again, I noticed that the narrative that Pokrovsk is a place of little strategic significance is again starting to appear. This is profoundly wrong. It is the single most strategically important point that the Russians have captured in Donbass up to now. More important strategically than, say, Bakhmut or Toretsk or even Severodonetsk and Mariupol. It breaks the wall, the fortified wall that the Ukrainians have created in Donbass, which is their last line of defense, based around the cities, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, and Pokrovsk. And it explains, and that explains, as Scott of Calibrated pointed out on our program on the Duran, why the Ukrainians have fought so hard and so long to retain it. I should add that I have also read an exceptional analysis of the Battle of Pokrovsk by the Russian analyst Sergei Poletayev, who also makes all of these very same points. So this is an important moment in the battle. And, well, as we've seen, Kupiansk is likely to fall before long as well. And the fall of Kupiansk in the north and Pokrovsk in the south undermines the entire remaining defensive architecture that the Ukrainians have created in Donbass. Now, there's also been equally dramatic news in other places. And we have been told, the Russians have said, that over the last few hours, the Russians have made further advances, further dramatic advances in the Zaporozhye region. This morning, they announced the capture of Novouspenivska, which is located in the area of the advance by the Russians in eastern Zaporozhye region. And the day before, the Russians announced that they had captured two other important places in the same area, which were the villages of Novoye and Sladkoye. If you actually look at the map of eastern Zaporozhye region, you can now see that there is no barrier, no further villages or settlements or forests or rivers or anything of that kind that lie between the Russians now and the town, the important town of Guliapolye, or of the road that leads to Guliapolye from the north. My own guess, and it's not just a guess, I mean, I'm not again a military tactician, but my own guess is that the Russians will not launch a direct attack on Guliapolye. They will probably first cut the road, then they will continue to advance westwards, capturing certain further villages that lie west of the road, and then they will have cut off all of the remaining supply routes, and Guliapolye will then be in a cauldron, and the Ukrainians will either have to make the decision to retreat from Guliapolye, or if they don't, they will be trapped there, just as the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk have both been trapped. Now, in the programme we did with him yesterday, Scott of Calibrated said that because of the focus on Pokrovsk, events in Zaporozhye region have failed to attract the attention that they deserve, that the Russian advance in this area is both irresistible and now very rapid. Prior to our doing the program with him yesterday, Scott of Calibrated pointed out that in this very same region, the Russians had captured, and there was video footage which confirms the capture, had captured 25 square kilometres of territory just in the course of a few hours. And he pointed out that this was an unprecedented rate of advance by comparison with what we have seen earlier in the war, until we go back to the early advances that the Russians and the Ukrainians each conducted against this each other at the start of the war, the first year of the war, in 2022. And he also pointed out that the Russians appear to have entirely cleared the sky of drones in this area of the Zaporozhye battlefronts, which means that Russian troops are able to move across the open country on foot and on vehicles without needing to fear attacks by Ukrainian drones, which continue to be common in the Pokrovsk area, though I get the sense that even there, they're becoming less effective and less common than they used to be. Now, Scott of Calibrated's comments about the importance of the Russian advance in Zaporozhye has been echoed by two other extremely astute commentators, each of whom supports different sides in the war. One is Marat Khairulin, who has also said that in his opinion, the Russian advance in Zaporozhye region is not getting the attention that it should. And the other is Julian Repke, the commentator and reporter of Germany's tabloid Bild Zeitung, who is an insightful and interesting commentator about the war, but who, of course, fervidly supports the Ukrainians. So we see three people, Scott of Calibrated, Marat Khairulin, Julian Röpke, all coming to the same view, that dramatic as the events in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk are, the Russian advance, the remorseless Russian advance in Zaporozhye region is at least as important. And all three, at least Marat Khairulin and Scott of Calibrated, make the same point, that in the event that Gulyapolye were to fall or even become surrounded, the Ukrainians would almost certainly face the loss of their other big town, Orekhov, as well. Now, to me, this indifference to what is happening in Zaporozhye region seems frankly remarkable. Because, of course, in 2022 and 2023, if you followed Western commentary at that time, and even some Ukrainian commentary, this was precisely the zone of destiny, the place where the war was going to be decided. Ukraine's great plan to win the war worked out in rough outline in the autumn of 2022 and then perfected after input from the United States and Britain over the following few months, was to win the war in precisely this territory. All of the armour that Germany and Britain and France and the United States, the Bradley infantry fighting vehicles, the Leopard 2 tanks, the Challenger tanks, all of that equipment which was supplied to Ukraine in the autumn of 2022 and in the winter of 2022-2023 was provided with the purpose of mounting the great summer offensive of 2023 in precisely this area, where the Ukrainians would recapture Mariupol, break through to the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, surround Crimea, place it in effect under siege, oblige the Russians to capitulate. That, I remember, was the plan, and it was massively discussed at the time. And there were articles after articles about this, and the Americans were massively invested in this plan. And we've learned from the New York Times and other places that the Americans, the American commanders, were actively controlling the movement of the Ukrainian troops in this precise area, and were bitterly complaining that instead of focusing all of their resources to win this decisive battle in precisely this region, in Zaporozhye region, where the Russians are now advancing, the Ukrainians instead were wasting their time trying first to defend and then to recapture Bakhmut in northern Donbass. Well, that was then. That was in 2023. Now that the Russians are conducting a successful offensive in this area, suddenly this territory is of no interest. It's truly remarkable. The Ukrainian offensive of 2023, summer 2023, behind which all of these resources were given, concerning which President Biden himself, as I remember reading at the time, worried that if it was not successful, it would damage his personal authority and international prestige. Anyway, that Ukrainian offensive of the summer of 2023 was an utter and complete failure. It failed even to dent the Russian defence lines. It scratched the paint, if you like, on the Russian fortifications. The Ukrainians suffered appalling losses. There are pictures, which I suspect will remain iconic pictures, of Leopard tanks and Bradley vehicles burning as they were caught on the Russian minefields. Anyway, that battle has receded, it seems, completely into the past, and as I said, was a total and disastrous failure. A Russian offensive in this very same area, gaining 25 square kilometers of territory in one day, passes by completely unnoticed and completely uncommented about. And let me repeat again that there is a mass of video footage which confirms the Russian advances, which, as I said, continue this morning. Well, what explains this? One reason, obviously, is that for the West, for the Western media, Russian advances, Russian offensives, especially on the very same territory where Ukraine and, by the way, NATO and the West failed, is obviously not newsworthy. But you would think that the Ukrainians themselves, Zelensky and Syrsky and the others, would be worried about this. After all, if the Ukrainians lose the whole of Zaporozhye region, that will bring the Russians also to the Dnieper, and it will place the Russians on the outskirts of the great industrial city of Zaporozhye. And I remember reading, I think it was about 2 years ago, an article in the Ukrainian magazine Strana, which said that one of the events which could lead to Ukraine's collapse and final defeat in the war would be the loss of the cities of Zaporozhye and Dnipro, of the Dnieper River, which, by the way, are located quite close to each other. So you would have thought that this would be a matter of concern. You would expect that Zelensky would have something to say about this. You would expect that Syrsky would be there. After all, he regularly tours the battlefronts. You would think that somebody in Kiev would be taking this all seriously. But no, there is little to no sign of any of that. Now, I am going to say something here, which I've said previously about Zelensky. I believe that in Zelensky's case, certainly since the failure of the 2023 offensive, for Zelensky personally, and perhaps some members of his team, the most important battlegrounds, the places which for them have the absolute priority, are those which are in closer proximity to the capital, to Kiev. When the Russians broke into Kharkiv in the spring of 2024, when the Russians advanced into Sumy region a few months ago, Zelensky and Syrsky were greatly alarmed. They transferred all the reinforcements that they could in order to hold the Russians back in these places. And the effect of that, by the way, was to significantly deplete Ukrainian resources in Donbass. Now, in Donbass, as the towns of Pokrovsk and Kupiansk are at risk of falling as the fortified line in western Donbass, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, begins to crumble. They're clearly alarmed about that too, because of course that contradicts the narrative they have been spreading to the West about the failure of the Russian offensive. And beyond that, they recognize that this line of towns in Donbass is Kiev's outer wall. If it falls, then it becomes much easier for the Russians to mount a second advance on Kiev, this time from the east and south, rather than from the north across the difficult roads from Belarus, as was the case in February 2022. So what goes on in faraway Zaporozhye region is much less significant. Having said that, it's nonetheless the case that Zelensky himself has been behaving increasingly strangely recently. He published yesterday two very, very strange posts on X. One spoke about how Putin is basically at the end of his tether, that he's used all sorts of resources in all sorts of places, but he's failed to make any real progress. The result is that he's becoming increasingly desperate. So all that is needed, presumably, in order to turn the situation is to apply the screws on Putin, to tighten up sanctions and increase weapons deliveries to Ukraine and do all of those things. And somehow, in some way, all will be well. The second post was basically Zelensky's own indirect admission about the devastating effect of the Russian missile and drone strike on Ukraine's electricity and energy system that I discussed extensively in my program yesterday. As I understand it, electric power continues to be sporadic across most Ukrainian cities. There is still a lot of work to do, apparently, to get the system back fully running. And of course, there is always the worry that before that happens, the Russians might come back and launch a further attack. Anyway, Zelensky admitted that Putin has many more missiles than Ukraine does. He lamented the lack of air defenses in Ukraine. He said that Ukrainian air defenses are thin and few and far between, though they do the best they can. And then, incredibly, astonishingly, he said that what Ukraine wants and is asking the West for, and when he says the West, basically he means the United States, is for 25 complete Patriot air defense systems. Now, that is a staggering ask. I believe that the total number of Patriot systems that the United States has is 50. And Zelensky is now asking for half of them. Even the United States would balk at a demand like this. If Zelensky were only asking 25 for 25 launch systems, even that, it seems to me, would be a big ask. But he seems to be asking for 25 complete systems. Now, his defenders would no doubt say that, well, you don't ask, you don't get. Zelensky's whole practice has been to ask for as many missiles as he can think of, and whilst the Western powers will never give him as many as he wants, he will at least get some. The problem with that is that the Ukrainians have themselves admitted that the effectiveness of the Patriot missiles has fallen to 6%. Probably, in my opinion, it is less than that. So, even by Ukrainian calculations or estimates, analysis, the Ukrainians are asking for many, many more of these missiles, which they themselves are admitting are losing effectiveness. It again is very strange. The other thing that seemed to me especially strange about these two posts from Zelensky is that their eerie disconnection from the realities on the battlefronts. Now, I accept that in a moment of crisis, it is important for the leader to appear calm, and I have to say this, that Zelensky has ever impressed me as an especially calm person. But calmness can be taken to extreme lengths in the midst of a crisis. And what we've had in these two posts is two posts which seem not to acknowledge the disastrous realities on the battle lines, the crisis in Pokrovsk that even Sirsky is now indirectly admitting to, the collapse in Kupiansk, where, of course, Zelensky just a few days ago were claiming that the Ukrainians had won a great battle and that they were busy clearing the 60 remaining Russians who were still in the town. Anyway, Zelensky isn't acknowledging any of that. He's not talking about the collapse in Zaporozhye region, the very area where, as I've just been saying, the Ukrainians mounted their great offensive of 2023, where they were which was supposed to win for them the war. He's not acknowledging the fact that the Russians have essentially completed the Battle of Volchansk and appear to be in the process of capturing the whole northeast of Kharkiv region. Scott have calibrated on the program we did with him yesterday, also discussed this part of the battle extensively and pointed out that were that to happen, the Russians would not only be close to Kharkiv, the city of Kharkiv, but would be on the high ground all around it. And, of course, Zelensky shows complete ignorance or indifference to the equally bad situation that's playing out in Siversk and Liman, which I am not going to discuss in this programme. To me, this does not look like a display of calmness. It looks like a complete disconnect, a total detachment from reality. Now, I have to say that in past lives, I've encountered precisely this sort of thing. In my previous work, I have come across instances of people who, even as everything falls apart around them, retreat into a kind of fantasy world where they simply no longer acknowledge the bad news
that is building up on all sides. And I'm starting to get the sense that this is happening to Zelensky as well. We've now reached this point in the war when the news is so bad that he can't even talk about it or admit to it any further. Well, perhaps I'm wrong, I don't know the man, but certainly there were two of the oddest tweets in this kind of situation that I have ever seen, that I have seen. Anyway, speaking of Zelensky, there is a lot of speculation that he is again under political trouble. NABU, one of the two anti-corruption agencies that he tried to close down, or rather bring under the control of his office a few months ago, triggering protests in Kiev itself, has initiated arrests of various functionaries who work within Ukraine's energy system. One of them has a historic connection to Zelensky himself, and there is a view that is widespread and which you find both in independent media and in mainstream media as well. In fact, I read it in the Financial Times, that these investigations conducted by NABU and the arrests of prominent officials that are following from them, that these arrests and these investigations are being perhaps engineered by Zelensky's opponents in Kiev, by former President Poroshenko, Mayor of Kiev Vitaly Klitschko, and people of that kind, and by some of Zelensky's critics in Europe, in order to embarrass him and to put pressure on him. I'm going to say this straight away, I'm not so sure. Zelensky himself has backed these investigations and done so publicly. And as I pointed out at the conclusion of his attempts to bring NABU and SABO, the other anti-corruption agency, to heel, I'm not fully convinced that he hasn't, since that episode, retained a measure of control. I read recently an article somewhere in the British media about how one of the officials of the energy system in Ukraine, who had been successful in keeping the lights on during earlier Russian missile strikes, had been sacked and placed under investigation on what appeared to be political grounds engineered by Zelensky and his team. We've just had a major Russian drone and missile strike on the Ukrainian energy system, and there have been other drone and missile strikes on the Ukrainian energy system by the Russians over the last few months. The cumulative effect of all of these strikes has been devastating. I wonder whether what is partly behind this is an attempt by Zelensky and perhaps some other officials to divert blame from themselves onto the people who have some actual role in operating the energy system, and also to use this episode to minimise the effect of the Russian strikes. Kiev is a snake pit of intrigue. It's very difficult for outsiders always to get a clearer understanding of what is actually taking place there. And whilst I accept that there is strong evidence, reasons to think that this latest affair is being carried out against Zelensky by his opponents. Part of me wonders otherwise. I would, anyway, on that point, just finish by saying that even if this is an attack on Zelensky, even if this attack, in conjunction with the public row between Zelensky himself and General Gnatov of the Ukrainian General Staff, gives reason to think that Zelensky himself is in serious trouble, I still think it's unlikely, all but inconceivable, that he is going to be removed. I think that in a crisis of the kind that Ukraine is facing, any attempt to do so would simply deepen the crisis and accelerate the already ongoing collapse. And for that reason, I think Ukrainian opposition leaders and European governments will balk at doing it. But even if Zelensky is removed, I still don't believe that is going to change any stance, any political stance in Kiev. I don't think it's going to make anyone in Kiev willing to make more concessions to the Russians. Because in my opinion, since the Maidan events of 2014, and even more since the start of the war in February 2022, the entire political structure in Kiev has been reorganized on purely anti-Russian lines. And I think that that precludes any possibility of anyone who emerges from the political system in Kiev engaging the Russians in serious concessions, because that would go totally against the entire political structures, the entire Kiev political structures, raison d'être. I simply don't think it's going to happen. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about Ukraine for the moment. There is no real sign in the West of any actual moves to change the situation. There is no diplomatic initiative to speak of. President Trump yesterday spoke again about how Ukraine was Joe Biden's war, how he wasn't involved in it. And he did say that the one great achievement that he had in connection with the war was that he had prevented it from escalating to World War III. I wonder whether that is a sign that President Trump is already signalling to European governments and to possible hardliners in the United States that there is one red line that he does not intend to cross, which is direct US participation in the war if Ukraine does indeed start to collapse. He's not prepared to go there, even insofar as giving a backstop to any European troops that people like Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer might be tempted to send to Ukraine in order to avert the ongoing collapse that is taking place there. But that is reading perhaps more meaning into President Trump's words than they actually have. The big story in Ukraine is that even as political games continue in Kiev, and as I've discussed in previous programs, It is an infallible sign of a system in acute crisis that political games of this sort start. We even saw them in Berlin in April 1945 as the Red Army closed in, just today. Anyway, this is an infallible sign that something like that is happening. But the big story continues to be these increasingly rapid advances by the Russian army in Ukraine and the collapse of the Ukrainians and their inability to hold the Russians back, and the lack of any plan or policy for this contingency that seems to exist so far in the West. Now, I mentioned Keir Starmer a moment ago, and I should say that Keir Starmer has again left London. He is now at the COP30 conference in Brazil, which is, of course, involved with discussions about the climate. Of course, for many people, this is a very, very important issue, and there will be many people in Britain that will welcome Keir Starmer's decision to attend that conference, just saying. But anyway, again, Keir has gone somewhere else. But we're starting to get more opinion polls appearing in Britain. The last one, as I discussed, the Labour Party now tied equal third with the Conservatives on just 16%, far behind Reform, which is on 32%, and just 1% behind the Greens, who are on 17%. Anyway, an unprecedented position for a government to be at this stage in the electoral cycle, and one which I cannot remember the Labour Party ever falling to at any time previously in my lifetime, just saying. And of course, there's been a great deal of commentary Britain about the continuing deterioration of the economy, with the Finance Minister Rachel Reeves now talking about tax increases in 2 weeks' time in her budget, and with suggestions, which are almost certainly true, that she's about to break the Labour Party's manifesto commitment by increasing the rates of income tax. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss that, but I am going to turn to the crisis that is currently convulsing the BBC. The BBC has been, through most of my life, one of the key institutions in Britain. Its cultural significance simply cannot be overstated. In my younger years, it was perhaps the one institution of the British state, remember it is a public broadcaster, with which everybody in Britain, or almost everybody in Britain, interacted on any particular day. Those days, in my opinion, have long since gone. And the time when the BBC was accepted by the British people as the new source of record has gone also. Now, in my opinion, the BBC was never the entirely impartial, completely objective, purely factual news source that some say. I'll give you an example that I remember from the early 1970s of how even at that time, at the time of the BBC's peak, you could detect certain biases in its news coverage. I mean, they were much milder than what we see today, and they were more subtle, but they existed. I remember how in coverage of the Vietnam War in the late 60s and early 70s, the BBC always referred to the South Vietnamese Army as the government troops and the North Vietnamese Army as the communists. Now that, of course, was factually true. The South Vietnamese Army was the army of a government, and the North Vietnamese Army were communists. But still, it did convey an impression, which I have no doubt was intentional, that the South Vietnamese had the greater legitimacy. And, well, that's just one example of what I mean. But anyway, it is the case that at that time, anybody who listened to the BBC probably would have come away thinking that this was overall a factual and mostly reliable news organisation. As I said, there were some biases, but they weren't particularly strong. Over the following years, that changed. And I'm going to say where the point which I personally believe was the great moment of change. And that came in 1987, when the Thatcher government engineered the resignation of the BBC's then Director General, Alistair Milne. Now, I'm not going to discuss in any detail the minutiae of that complex story, but it seems to me that from that moment on, the BBC's political coverage began to become less reliable and more overtly political. And over the last few years, that trend has increased markedly. Now, the crisis that has engulfed the BBC at the moment concerns the BBC's splicing of a speech made by President Trump back in January 2021, connected to certain events in the Congress, in the Capitol, which everybody, of course, knows about. There were other complaints also relating to parts of the BBC's Middle East coverage. Various people, I've noticed, are pursuing political agendas around this as well. I would say that I think that the BBC's defenders are greatly understating the significance of the splicing, the editing of Donald Trump's speech. I think the way the speech was edited, and I say this without any doubt, was undoubtedly intended to give the impression that President Trump incited the events that took place on January 6th, 2021, and did so purposefully and intentionally. And, well, doing that was not just wrong, but frankly, in my opinion, dishonest journalistic practice. My point is that nothing that is going to happen to the BBC, in my opinion, is going to make anything better. whoever wins the current battle for the BBC is going to want to continue to use it as its as a political tool, and the days of its, well, reasonably reliable, factually unbiased news coverage are long, long gone. The BBC is no longer the institution that it once was, and that key institution in British life that it used to be. In fact, its decline, and I think in terms of its new service, we are talking about a decline, in my opinion, is going to continue and reflects the fundamental changes that are taking place in Britain all the time, and which I personally do at times find bewildering. Now, today is the 11th of November, the 11th day of the 11th month. On this day, throughout my lifetime, people in Britain regularly commemorated the armistice which ended the First World War and remembered the deaths of the thousands, the hundreds of thousands or millions who'd served in the British military in the various wars. One of the things which again I notice with surprise and not a little dismay is how that commemoration over the last few years has withered into non-existence. In public places especially, people, I remember, always wore a red poppy on this day. I intend to do so. I am one of the few who, at least in my part of London, still do. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Remembrances of things past, if you like. But anyway, that's what I wanted to say at the conclusion of this programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all my programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Please also remember to check out our Substack blog. Last but not least, check out our shop and don't forget to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.